York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, the latest study on how breast cancer patients can forgo chemotherapy. I have some important questions on this study from Loyola University Health System. Then we're going to look at some interesting perspectives. I'm going to share two different journalist reports. One is from Melanie Phillips at a major meeting, and where she discusses how the media manipulates the truth. Now, it's a long lecture. I'm only giving you about 6 minutes. But those 6 minutes, to me, she reveals something that we haven't heard before. And then from the Times of London, arguably the finest newspaper in the world, one of its important editors is Andrew Norfolk. And he tells you about something that needs to be discussed, and is not, for politically correct reasons. For those of you who listen to this program for some time, do you remember about 10 years ago, I did a program on how people associated with Boys Town, remember the movie with Mickey Rooney and Spencer Tracy with that Boys Town, how they were being recruited in a pedophilia ring. This turns out to have been a Republican pedophilia ring where some of the boys even went to the White House in the evening and did a tour, and how no media would touch it. Now, I did that during the Bush administration. I did a whole hour. I even spoke with the adults who had gone through all that and who were telling their story. But it's as if the media did not want to hear that story implicating some very powerful and wealthy and politically connected Republicans. I then did another one that no one would hear about either, on Jeffrey Epstein's Lolita Express. And it was, he had this orgy island where he had three villas. President Clinton visited that 26 times, several times, without his Secret Service protection. Why? And yet he's talking today, this morning, on the Today Show about how, well, he apologized and he did the right thing by not resigning, and the public supports him, the majority of the public supports him, and that's old news, let's go forward. There shouldn't be two standards. It should not matter whether you're Democrat or Republican, in or out of office, a celebrity or a common person. If you commit a crime, by any standard, you should be held accountable. But why is there a double standard and some people are not held accountable? This is what we're going to discuss, but we're going to do two things. We're going to have what Melanie Phillips says is how our minds are being manipulated, and then what Andrew Norfolk said was over 1,400 young children being sexually traded and groomed for prostitution and abuse, and yet the perpetrators were not held accountable. And he was on this case, and nobody would cooperate until finally there were arrests. Guess who they arrested? You'll hear him say it. So this is a little unusual in today's broadcast. Then also we have Professor Mark Crispin Miller. He is professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University, where he specializes in modern propaganda and the history of advertising. And he is the lead chief editor of the series Forbidden Bookshelf at Open Road Media, which republishes important books that have been censored or banned or ignored or wrongly criticized in the course of American history, like I.F. Stone and Lewis Mumford or Pierre Dale Scott or Christopher Simpson and others. And he will be here to talk about the left forum and the crisis in the left in its own legitimate identity. I think you'll find this of interest. Let's begin, always, with the latest on health and healing. A 21-gene test performed on tumors could enable most patients with the most common type of early breast cancer to safely forego chemotherapy. And that was just published today in the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, Loyola Medicine oncologist Kathy Albain, medical doctor, is among the many co-authors of the study and a member of the Clinical Trial Steering Committee. And what they're saying is, quote, with the results of this groundbreaking study, we now can safely avoid chemotherapy in about 70% of patients who are diagnosed with the most common form of breast cancer. For countless women and their doctors, the days of uncertainty are over. That's very good news. But here is what is not understood, and here's what's left out of the story. There have been scientists, one just passed a few weeks ago, who I had on the show many, many times, Samuel Epstein, who was saying this back in the 1970s on my radio program at that time. We wrote several articles together. In fact, there were numerous oncologists, board certified in oncology, who also believed that they would not use chemotherapy because, as they said several times to me, Gary, I can't tell if the woman died from the chemotherapy or from the cancer. My concern is we know what the chemotherapy will do. It will destroy some cancer cells, but for every cancer cell it kills, it could kill 1,000 healthy cells or more. And then there are those physicians who, rightly so, have been using holistic modalities to help their patients with breast cancer. And when you know it, none of the tens of thousands of their patients who have reversed cancer without chemotherapy have been acknowledged. And yet, if anyone receives chemotherapy and survives, 100% of the credit is given to chemotherapy. That's complete nonsense. You cannot say that if you took the flu shot and didn't get the flu, it was 100% because of the flu shot. What if you lived in a sunshine state like Texas, Florida, California, Arizona? You were out a lot, got a lot of vitamin D3. That's known to protect us against influenza. What if you're reading a plant-based healthy diet with more fruits and vegetables, more juices? What if your immune system was stronger? What if you were happier? What if you were less stressed? What if you exercised? What if you took vitamin C on a daily basis? All these can mitigate the immune response. And yet, in its feeble-minded attempt to qualify the insanity of orthodox medicine's monotheistic mindset, it says if you got a procedure and you survived, it was only because of the procedure, nothing else. And that's called science-based medicine. So finally, they're saying, gee whiz, but here's what they didn't say. Oh, and by the way, all of the doctors and all the holistic nurses who were advising their patients with early stage most common breast cancer not to get chemotherapy, you were right. Oh, and by the way, you probably saved 5 million women's lives in the process. You see, they only tell you half the story. From Oxford University, Alzheimer's brain shrinkage is slowed down by the omega-3 fatty acids in the B complex. The ulcer of the study on Alzheimer's disease and other dementia represents a conference on this whole topic, and they showed major breakthroughs in the treatment of the illness. Now, they're publishing this in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition today, and what they're saying is the omega-3 fatty acids make a big difference. Quote, it is the first treatment to show Alzheimer's-related brain shrinkage can be prevented. It means that something so simple as keeping your omega-3 levels high and supplementing B vitamins, if you're at risk, could dramatically reduce a person's risk, end quote. B6, B12, folic acid, you bet. And that, the key is take them now on a daily basis and watch how you can keep the brain from shrinking and help protect you. Also, two supplements that you've heard me mention many times on this program, curcumin, cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N, and quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, are good against lung cancer. And this is from the Jinzhou University of Medicine in China. So according to this new reporting, quote, lung cancer is responsible for increase in mortality due to cancer-related deaths, and new approaches are being explored for the betterment of the situation. And in the first study, chemo-preventative efficacy of curcumin and quercetin were investigated and against lung carcinogenesis, and it had very positive results. So, this is not the first study showing curcumin is good against cancer. There are 1,000 others. And quercetin also. I recommend them on a daily basis. Also, something unique from Trent University, which is on Ontario, Canada. Is it possible that your blood sugar could be elevated due to electromagnetic hypersensitivity? The incidence of diabetes is growing. It's virtually at a pandemic level in the United States. In fact, last evening, I did a webinar, a three-hour webinar, on heart disease, diabetes, and overweight, and took a lot of questions and gave a lot of insights. And by the way, I'm sorry for all of you who tried to get on. You tried too late, and unfortunately, our bandwidth was full. Remember, we have a huge audience all around the world. I believe our last statistic showed 66,000 listening from India alone. I mean, so when we do a webinar, and the reason I'm doing webinars is because I can reach a whole worldwide audience instead of just a single room audience. I like to do both, but you reach people who couldn't otherwise be in attendance. And as I said, when you're overweight, you have a much higher incidence of diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and heart attacks. So by dealing with all three, you're able to lower that. What I did not include was the idea that electromagnetic pulses from your cell phone, from your computer, from overhead G5 towers could impact your blood sugar level for diabetes. Well, now we have some study of evidence that shows that there is a hypersensitivity to electromagnetic fields, and that in itself can cause high blood sugar. You've never heard this before, brand new today, and they're calling it type 3 diabetes, and it's because it's due to environmental pollution, what they call dirty electricity. And according to the peer-reviewed research conducted by Dr. Havis and published in Electromagnetic Biology and Medicine, quote, dirty electricity or transient electrical fields can affect blood sugar levels in diabetic individuals who are electrically sensitive. Well, something new. So, if you're diabetic, make sure that you're not having any electromagnetic appliances right by you. Put your computer screen further away, ideally 5 feet, and use your speaker for cell phones, and turn off your routers at night. Just some simple things can make a difference. Also, a lot of people get colonoscopies. Now, if you have a reason to, fine. But they're also associated with high levels of infection. This is from Johns Hopkins University. Colonoscopies and other GI endoscopies performed at outpatients specialty centers all around the United States result, quote, in far more infections than previously believed. An analysis shows that patients who had one of the common procedures at facilities known as ambulatory surgery centers were at greater risk than expected of bacterial infections, including E. coli and Klebsiella. Quote, though patients are routinely told that common endoscopic procedures are safe, we found that post-endoscopic infections are more common than we thought. And so what do we do? All right. Most people will continue getting these. And I think you should do three things. First, increase the amount of soluble fiber in your diet to 50 grams a day. Secondly, begin to take 6 glasses of chlorophyll-rich vegetable juices per day. And your best juice would be green apple, celery, and cucumber, 10-ounce glasses. Then take probiotics 3 times a day, anywhere from 10 to 20 billion. If you do that for 1 month, then normal obstructions and normal slowness, peristalsis, movement of your colon will be cleansed and frequently rebalanced. Then if you still have bleeding and inflammation problems, then a colonoscopy would be wise to see if you have polyps or precancerous lesions. But a meat-based diet, lots of fat in the diet, are really going to contribute to that. And someone sent me an email yesterday, thought I'd find this of interest. And it was about a young woman, I'm guessing in her early 20s, who was eating a big steak. And when I say big, this was 74 ounces. And she ate the whole thing in like 16, 17 minutes. That's a pretty good size serving. I mean, how many people could even consume that amount? And so I wrote the person back. Not only was it foolish, but just look at the, break it down. And here's how it breaks down. That person was consuming 10 days worth of protein in one meal. That meant that for the next 6 hours, her blood was going to be extremely dense with fat, which means her platelets are going to aggregate or clump together. That means she was at greater risk of a stroke or heart attack. Also lowered oxygen levels in the blood, all from what she did. And that's just part of it, increasing the urea and nitrogen in the blood substantially, both of which are toxic to the liver and kidneys. And the math is simple. If she had 8 grams or 8 ounces, excuse me, of, it's 1,008 calories or grams of fat, which is 8,064 calories, and it's 1,008 grams of protein, which is 4,032 calories. She consumed 12,100 calories in one item. Whoa. Actually, that's 20 days worth of protein based upon what she would need per day. That's a death sandwich, by the way. No one should be having these high-protein diets. But people who have the most colorectal cancer, polyps, gastrointestinal conditions are on high-protein diets. Not a good idea. And from the University of Arizona, if you're eating junk food at night, then you're going to end up with sleep loss, and almost always. So don't snack at night. Get rid of the junk food cravings. What are the two best ways of doing it? Take some ice, squeeze the juice of one lemon or a teaspoon of lemon juice into a cold glass of ice water. Drink it down. The lemon and the cold water kill your appetite. Or take some popcorn, just plain popcorn, organic popcorn. Doesn't add calories, hence it won't impact your metabolism, making it more anabolic, but at least you will feel that you have something in you. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. I'm going to go through several short, important pieces. This is from the London School of Economics. They say an economic model significantly underestimates climate change risk. Quote, from Review of Environmental Economics and Policy, they're saying that the integrated assessment models currently used by economists largely ignores potential for tipping points beyond which impacts accelerate, become unstoppable, or become irreversible. They inadequately account for the potential damage from climate change, especially at moderate to high levels of warming due to rising the global mean temperature of more than 2 degrees Celsius. in lay language. Right now, we have over 30 tipping points. Half of them have tipped. There's nothing that's going to be done, could be done to reverse it. The others are tipping. Let me give you an example. Global warming from all sources, man-made and natural, caused the ice in the Arctic to melt. Normally, the sun hits the ice and bounces harmlessly back into the atmosphere. But once that ice is gone, it goes into the water. The water is shallow. It's not 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet. It's 500 feet frequently. Then it warms up the methane that has been frozen in the mud and muck. And that releases billions of methane bubbles that have a far greater capacity to create global warming than CO2, carbon dioxide. Then, once that water heats up, the next cycle comes along of snow and ice creation, and it's thinner and less, until within 5 years from now, you have a substantial part of the year where the Arctic is ice-free. That means then that the temperature's warmed up in the mountain ranges. It's happening now, where if you used to go out to the Rocky Mountains and you would see the snow could be 10 feet thick. Now it's much, much less, and it would take its time melting. It might melt over 6 months, supplying the rivers, tributaries, and the dams like Lake Mead. Now it's not. Very little water is getting out, and yet it's supposed to supply 40 million people in the Southwest with just a little Colorado. Can't do it. That's a feedback loop that is gone, and it's going to be gone completely for most of the people. There just won't be enough water. Where are you going to get your water? They're going to try to now put gigantic pipes that run over the entire Corn Belt area of America. We're talking about Kansas, Indiana, Illinois, and probably Colorado, going clear out to Lake Erie, Lake Michigan, and draw water from there. Well, how do you think that's going to work? So if you take it from one area to another, it's enormous expense, and it still means you have non-sustainable environment. So that means, like right now in California, you cannot both take a shower and do your washing machine in the same day, I believe it is. They just put some new rules into effect because they're in an extended drought. The drought's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. They're already destroying thousands of acres of fruit trees because there's no water to them. What water there is politically and economically controlled. Who gets it? So these are feedback loops. So what if in your economics you're not accounting for this? I'll give you another example, one a little closer to home. Miami Beach. I lived in Miami Beach for 15 years. Second Street and Ocean Drive. And it was a wonderful environment. I was there before the development. I was there when it was still a ghetto. But I loved it, running on the beach each morning, really special. Get up, it's dark. And on my way back of a 10-mile run, I'd see the bulldozers. And that was the first tip-off. Bulldozers bring in from the barges, taking the sand off barges, and those barges were coming from south, from the Bahamas at that time. Now the Bahamas no longer has enough sand to give, so it's going to other places. And it would smooth it all out, so by the time the people came out later for their volleyball and enjoying the beach, they'd never know that there wouldn't be a beach there within a couple weeks. It'd just be all rocks, and if it weren't being constantly groomed at night. I just posted today on my Facebook a photograph. Now, when you look at it, you think that's India. That's Pakistan. No, that's Paris. Behind the beautiful buildings, and certainly Paris is one of the most beautiful cities in the world, and one I would recommend people visit for their cuisine, for the French culture, for their history. But right behind the main buildings, as far as the eye can see, nonstop poverty with little tiny tents. I mean, miles it goes on. It's still Paris. It's just invisible. It's what you don't see that people would change their perception if they saw the truth of something. In any case, they're not dealing with it. If you're not going to deal with the problem, and then you have to hide it. You know, if you hide the problem, does it go away? It doesn't go away. Sooner or later, it's going to manifest. And then you've got a negative feedback loop. So everywhere we have these feedback loops. So one day I see the seaweed, and I notice that's strange. The tide comes in at night, high tide, and when it goes back out in the morning, it leaves seaweed where the high tide was. And I just keep seeing over months the seaweed going further and further and further inland until finally one day I saw it on the base of a swimming pool, outdoor swimming pool on the bottom of it. And I said, this is not good. Because every single building, probably 20,000 buildings from Key West right up the East Coast, not one of those is built on rock. It's all built on sand. Concrete pilings go in, but it's sand. And I don't care how large or how magnificent or how beautiful or expensive the apartment building, you're as vulnerable as the tides pulling out the sand. And when that happens, your structure is going to become unsafe. And then you're going to have a massive run to get out of that market. Already, Alton Road, on one end is Ocean Drive, and 8 blocks over is Alton Road, and that's the bay is there. They're pumping water out every night. It's just it's a Band-Aid on a cancer. And yet more people are moving there, paying more money for the property. That's a negative feedback loop. It's beyond our capacity to change anything. Now they're talking about building a new road further inland. Well, good luck with that, because you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of homes that you would have to get eminent domain on. It would cost you $10 to $20 billion. And where are you going to get that when the state doesn't have any money to even close its own budget on pensions and other debt it owes? But that's what happens when, at the end of the day, people are where they shouldn't be at that time. Might have been great before, it's not. So we have a real hard time in America of looking ahead, saying what is the likely outcome, I'm in the right place at the right time, and the environment is supported and sustainable. We don't have it. In fact, on Hawaii's Big Island, we haven't seen the big blow yet. If we see the big blow, you can expect a massive tsunami. We're talking about a tsunami never before seen. It's almost certain there's going to be a big eruption. When, we don't know. But ask 2 months ago, people, did they concern themselves about a volcano? And they said, what volcano? No. Of course not. There's always some volcano. The whole islands are built upon volcano. They're going to be here forever. I wouldn't count upon it. So already that substation was consumed over the weekend. And here was a couple. And the woman was speaking, saying, we just got out. And you have to think, well, hold on a second. You're watching every single day on television that the volcano and the lava fields are coming and new fissures opening, 22 fissures open. It's coming in your direction and nothing can stop it. So you're telling me that you didn't move a thing. You didn't take any possessions or clothes or photographs or whatever is important to you. You didn't take a single thing and get out of there? No. And why do we keep hearing the same story, whether it's a volcano or an earthquake or a tidal wave or any other natural disaster? What cognitive disconnect are we living in that doesn't allow us to see what's in front of us? So when the Review of Environmental Economics and Policy is telling us we're not paying attention, we're not acting in our own behest, we're not thinking, am I in a sustainable environment for the future? Then you're playing Russian roulette. And you want to know how that works? Well, come down to Florida to my ranch and take a look at all the homes, all of them. They've all got tarpons. Why not repaired? Insurance companies are only giving them 3%. They offer me 3% on my damage. Fortunately, I planned on a hurricane coming, so I was still able to put trees back in the ground because I can work a bobcat and redo a lot. The average person can't. They have no skills, none. so they have to get exploited by people come up in trucks and want to charge them $1,000 to take a fallen tree off the ground. Well, if you don't know how to put a tree back in a hole, what are you going to do? You're going to give $1,000. But what if you're just, I'm in a working class neighborhood. What do you do if you're just a working class person? The average working class person doesn't have $2,000 in their savings account. So exactly how they're supposed to pay for this, they don't. And so as a result, 9 months later, damages still exist. That's a negative feedback loop. Is it going to happen again and again and again? It's going to get worse and worse and worse. So how smart is it to stay in a place where you know you're going to get slammed again? Not very bright. Are they considering the economic consequences of what happens when Miami is a no-go zone? Because all it's going to take is one Category 4, and it's over for all of Miami. That's it. They're not even counting this. They don't assume that. They don't assume where you're going to put the millions upon millions of people in Florida who are going to have one, two, or three storms of Category 3, 4, 5 per year. At that point, there's not going to be any insurance. Lloyd's of London, these other insurance companies are not going to insure anything. So then you're going to lose everything. That is the reality we're not willing to face. And we should, because it's coming right after us. And this is from Terry Padden of Earth Island News. Only radical environmental activism can bring about whole system change. Quote, to come to terms with the many dimensions of our ecological crisis, we need to co-create conscious, connected communities and act together. A healthy future for humanity requires a healthy living planet, and our growth economy based on constant material expansion has become incompatible with the health of our finite planet. By transitioning beyond a growth-dependent industrial economy, we require a multidimensional transformation, not just outward political and economic change, but radical cultural and psychological change as well. This means that to radically re-engineer the system, we will have to simultaneously re-engineer ourselves. This is whole system transformation, requiring a healthier, more creative, more compassionate and engaged humanity that we have seen up to now. I agree with that. I think Terry made some very important comments. However, let's be very realistic for a moment, just a moment. A, we are not a compassionate society. We have a corrupt body politic. We have a corrupt financial system that is supporting the constant growth, never-ending finite resource can always be used. We have a manifest destiny complex. We engineer change in all other cultures where we can exploit it for political or economic gain. We then have a three-tiered system. We have the largest single tier is the poor people. They're not even considered essential because now with robotics, artificial intelligence, we can do without them in the workplace, and we're doing that at an astronomically fast level. And now China is challenging the United States in artificial intelligence, where one intelligence system can do the work of 1,000 individuals within the workforce. I'll go into this in greater detail to show you who those people are most likely to be replaced by intelligent design and transhumanism. And that's not the future. That's right now as we speak. So we don't care about the average worker. We don't care about their family. We don't care about their kids are hungry. We don't care about if they have a place to live. We do care very much if you're poor and you're living in California that you not embarrass the rest of society by sleeping in a car, a van, or an RV, or walking around the beach, because that makes it seem unseemly for people who can afford to live there. And, of course, affording to live anywhere is a problem now. You can afford to live in Cleveland and Columbus, so therefore they're go-to destinations. Why anybody will live there is beyond me, but being from West Virginia, being in Cleveland, and there are better places to live, nice people, but wouldn't be my aesthetic first choice in environment. But it tells us something when people are saying, well, where can I afford to live? Well, you can only afford to live in the boondocks or in this place. But I want to live in New York. You can't afford it. I want to live in San Francisco. You really can't afford it. I want to live in Canada. Let's go over to the west coast of Canada. That's the hot ticket. Nobody can afford to live there. It's highest rents in the world. And so every place you thought you would like to be, you suddenly realize you can't afford to be there. So we have to do a whole new rethink. Are we building communities for the people, or are we building just to exploit and make as much money for the developers and the people as possible, genderfy it, and forget about the people who can't afford to live anywhere, can't afford to buy food, can't afford an education. And if they do get an education, they're frequently a debt slave to their education. So you see, and please understand the concept of what I'm saying here. It's good to envision a society that can have a Marshall Plan for the environment, which it desperately needs. It's a different matter in trying to take the existing consumer consciousness that thinks it's a great idea when a Kardashian takes the idea of something environmental to the president, when nothing is going to happen by that, but she's got a great photo op, and it's because of her husband's relationship with the president. They exploited that as quickly as they could. Ask her three questions about the environment, and her head will burst. That's the problem. We have a celebrity-based culture that is completely ignorant, with a few exceptions, of the actual issues. And the average person intentionally stays ignorant. So then we relegate ourselves to left and right instead of good and bad. We relegate ourselves to those in power should be the ones who dictate, from the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, the Business Roundtable, to all of the free enterprise institutes and all the other people who have money in the game, and therefore they want to control the game and the rules, and they do. We could have a phenomenally successful society for everyone if we got rid of the military-industrial complex and the politicians and the neoliberals who support them. But we won't. In fact, nothing is going to change. Nothing. So instead of being frustrated and being Bill McKibben or one of the others who believes in these kind of utopias that are never going to happen, get real. That does not mean angry or negative. It means you can't change any institution, because no institution in America is going to change. The media is not going to change. The left's not going to change. The right's not going to change. Stupid's not going to change. Narcissism's not going to change. Nothing is going to change, because nothing has changed. So what we can do is we can start to change ourselves. That I agree with. We can work with other people where we decide where is the best place to live. How best can I raise a family? How best can I be a friend? How best can I serve the needs of society and look at those in need? By the way, I posted a little video. I first saw this a couple of years ago. It was of a homeless man, all raggedy looking and unshaved. And there was a piano that someone had put out in front of a bar in Florida. And he just happened to sit down and started to play. And he played beautiful, beautiful classical music. And someone videoed it, put it up, and it went viral. And then they started putting these pianos around the town, like 60 of them. Anybody could sit down and play. And he was seen a couple times. And then he started getting offers to play in some bars where they had the pianos. And there was a GoFund started by someone in the audience, and they raised $40,000. Next thing you know, this guy, he gets a shave and puts on some clothes, and he looks like a totally different person. You'd never recognize him. And he's playing the piano and beautiful music, and he ends up in a great relationship, and now he's a happy person. And you love to hear stories like that. I do. It warms the heart. In fact, I just posted one on Friday. This one you got to see. You talk about touching your heart. This will touch your heart. They wanted to see what would a homeless guy do with money. So they dropped a billfold as he's walking down the street, and this homeless guy sees it. And they're filming this from a van across the street. And the homeless guy picks up the wallet, looks in it, and then runs down the street and gets the guy and says, "You dropped your wallet." And the guy says, "Well, why'd you give it to me?" "Well, it's the right thing to do." So then he gives the guy some money. I don't know how much. And the guy then goes into a store, and they're still filming, and he comes out with all these white bags. And he goes to all the other homeless people. Think of that. Do you know a single politician that would ever do that? Would the Clintons do that? No, they're looking for money in your bag to take. This is such a beautiful soul. And yet he had nothing. But whatever he didn't have, he was still willing to share what little bit he could with another human being in pain. That is our spiritual responsibility. That's why we cannot walk away from a crisis. We cannot walk away from the truth when it needs to be spoken and when we can make a difference. That's what I see as a positive future, when more people come together with that kind of mindset. We're going to take a break and come back with my guest, who's going to share some truths that the left hasn't want to hear, but should. And we're going to share it today. And let's now say hello to Professor Mark Crispin Miller. I gave you his bio earlier. He's professor of media and culture and communications at New York University. Nice to have you with us today, Mark.
It's good to be back, Gary. Thanks for having me on.
Mark, the Left Forum convened over the weekend, which is a long history of opening the forum for censored voices about domestic and foreign affairs. And I support that. That's why I've attended many times, at least when I'm in New York. What was surprising is that one panel censored dealt with the Palestinian crisis and was called, "Is Talking About Gaza Anti-Semitic Hate Speech?" It was going to provide firsthand descriptions of conditions in Gaza. And this is immediately in the aftermath of the Gazan return, peace march, and Israeli wounding and killing over 120 people as of today and more than 10,000 injured. I don't want to get into the fine details of the Gazan situation, but this censorship raises some serious questions about the state of the left today and the influence of the Anti-Defamation League and a Jewish international nonprofit organization has over the left when it comes to identifying pro-Palestinian sentiments with being anti-Semitic. As if anything you say at all in defense of the Palestinians' right to peace is anti-Semitic. We already know from the incredible work of Norman Finkelstein and others that it has been a strategy of the Israeli lobby to equate criticism against Israel and Zionism with anti-Semitism, which is quite ridiculous on the face of it. Palestinians are Semitic also, but the definitions have been grossly distorted. And according to a report I read, another panel focused on fake news and censorship, including the criminalization of criticizing, targeting Israel, that you were on along with Ray McGovern and Jerry Daughtry, which also was rejected and censored. And in 2016, several panels were banned, including one with William Pepper and Russ Baker. Those are two of the most progressive minds in America, and they wanted to look at the assassinations and their cover-ups. So my question is, how do you make sense of these censorships within an event that has been associated with the more extreme and perhaps the more truthful left? The forum is yours.
Yeah, thanks. Well, we could go in two directions with this discussion, because on the one hand, there is the all-pervasive blackout, you might say, on investigation, discussion, commentary that is critical of Zionism and or the liquid government. I'm kind of an activist in this field. I edit a series called The Forbidden Bookshelf, which brings back works, important writings that were variously killed at birth. One of the books we revived last year is by Moshe Menuhin, the father of the great violinist Yehudi Menuhin, who was an absolutely committed anti-Zionist all his adult life, and his anti-Zionism was based on Jewish grounds. The book that we published had originally come out in 1965. He couldn't find a publisher for it anywhere in the United States or in Europe. It was finally published by the Institute for Palestine Studies. The book is called Not by Might Nor by Power, The Zionist Betrayal of Judaism. It is an absolutely indispensable history of Zionism. And this is from someone who had spent decades fighting Zionism on Jewish grounds, who had been censored and smeared and so on, and who was himself born in Palestine. So it's a really fascinating book. We brought it back. It's available in the Forbidden Bookshelf series. And I'm only saying this to indicate that I'm acutely sensitive to this whole problem. I've been trying to fundraise for some nurses in Gaza. We found that both GoFundMe and Fundraiser were blocking any attempts to send money over there to help these nurses treat the wounded and prevent people from dying, which strikes me as a crime against humanity. At any rate, this is one subject we could talk about for an hour, you and I. But I don't want to do that because I don't want this discussion to overfocus on that one example of how the left has been hijacked and muted, and I guess it's not an exaggeration to say castrated, for quite a while. And you implied as much when you mentioned that the panel with Bill Pepper and Russ Baker was also rejected, the panel dealing with the key assassinations of the 60s. The fact of the matter is that the left in this country has been co-opted. It is the compliant left. It is a left whose teeth have been, as if, you know, surgically removed. And we can speculate as to how this has been done. But you know, before I do that very briefly, because we don't have a lot of time, I just want to note that someone like Noam Chomsky, who is a luminary figure, who is arguably the most famous American leftist in, you know, of the 20th and 21st centuries, who has done a great deal of terrific work. Noam Chomsky has on certain extremely important issues held positions that are indistinguishable from the New York Times and ultimately the government. And I'm talking about the Kennedy assassination and the other assassinations of that era. I'm talking about 9/11. I'm talking about Bush-Cheney's election theft. On these issues, Chomsky is derisive, dismissive, ill-informed, and contemptuous of any attempt even to argue with him. And I say this as someone who has tried to do so. That is extremely troubling to me, and it suggests that, you know, what the strategy behind this is, and whether he's aware of it or not, I can't say. The strategy is that on those issues that could conceivably prompt widespread resistance or even rebellion, you know, I mean, if most people actually knew for a fact that the government of this country was involved in setting up 9/11, if they knew for a fact that this country was at this government had actually orchestrated the assassination of an American president and other key figures, including Martin Luther King. If the people of this country knew for a fact that their elections were rigged not by Russia, but by operatives of the Republican Party, it could have really dramatic consequences. It could create serious unrest. Those are the issues on which Chomsky has been a denialist, violating his own high scholarly standards, whereas he's done excellent work on a broad range of issues that matter only to the left, see? So he's functioned, again, whether knowingly or not, I have no idea, as a kind of gatekeeper. I think the same is true of Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, and I've been on that show many times. Here again, you know, she has functioned to kind of keep the gates closed against discussion of any issues that might be dismissed as so-called conspiracy theory. And both she and Chomsky recently have piled on the Assad government. They have, she particularly has been a vocal champion of the white helmets. She has had guests on who are defending the uprisings in Caracas, the so-called Gucci protests against the Maduro government. She has been an ardent critic of Putin. She has had Pussy Riot on her show several times. I mean, these are guests. These are positions that are heartily endorsed and defended by the U.S. State Department and the Atlantic Council. And, you know, interests like that, that's a very peculiar way for someone nominally leftist to behave. And I think that it's not really a stretch to infer from all this that there is some deep state involvement in the so-called left, the celebrity left, the most visible and influential individuals and broadcasts and publications of the left, which would tell us that the CIA has done in this country what it has actually been doing for decades in other countries, which is to co-opt progressives, you know, in favor of or in support of a kind of anti-Soviet program, you know. Now, the deep state question was dramatically foregrounded, as you note, by the fact that the Left Forum has been rejecting all these panels, which are perfectly legitimate and reasonable panels. If people want more, you know, detailed background on all this, I suggest they go to deeptruth.info, where there's a lot of information on the background and the details of this refusal by Left Forum to allow these conversations to take place. I also want to add that from Friday through Sunday, that is this weekend, there will be an online symposium of, involving discussion of all these different subjects. And I'm going to be speaking myself.
Yeah, I'm going to give that information in a moment. I might mention, Mark, that we were the first radio show to expose the White Helmets as a fraudulent terrorist group and where they got their money. And also we had the different journalists, legitimate journalists, who were in Aleppo and other cities, Ghouta, who said that it was not sarin gas from Assad. And they've been able to document the truth, but the American media won't publish it. And we challenged the Academy for giving them the White Helmets a best Oscar for short documentary. And we actually had video on from a reporter from Brazil showing you the truth about the hospital. Wasn't a hospital, it was a munitions holding place for ISIS. All the truths came out, and yet no one on the left would touch that. Well, why doesn't Amy Goodman and Noam Chomsky and others who believe that the liberation of Libya was a good thing, why don't they go there today and speak with the people and just tour all of Libya, unescorted, of course? You could go anywhere in Libya at one time because it was the Paris of Africa, and see what they did. Are they willing to take any responsibility? Because if you're advocating for regime change, and there is regime change, and then no one on the left is critical of the Clintons or Obamas for engaging in regime change, then we have a problem. Also, they banned Kevin Aziz and Glenn Ford. They were banned.
Right.
And from the Left Forum, they wanted to talk about the corporate and deep state infiltrating the left. And no go.
Well, that refusal sort of makes their point, doesn't it? I mean, why would the Left Forum ban a discussion of that problem unless it's to prevent any kind of critical consideration of what the Left Forum is all about? People who go to deeptruth.info will find information about the Rosa Luxemburg Institute, which is a major funder of the Left Forum, and it turns out that so-called institute is largely funded by the German government and was extremely active in promoting the so-called Maidan revolution in Ukraine, you know, which is a revolution that installed a government comprised of technocrats and neo-Nazis. I mean, outspoken neo-Nazis. You know, when you have a left-wing organization named after Rosa Luxemburg that's supporting a bogus revolution like that, you've got a very, very serious problem. That the left has corrupted as those other institutions that you mentioned before you started talking to me. The corruption runs wide and deep, which means that it really is time, and I'm picking up on a point you made a moment ago, it really is time for us to just forget the whole left-right distinction. Stop treating the left like a big club of, you know, right-minded folks who have all the proper opinions and so on. I think it's time for the have-nots to join hands across ethnic and ideological lines. I mean, you obviously can't make common cause with conscious neo-fascists, but there are a lot of people on the right who are not fascists and who are properly distrustful of the state in ways that liberals tend not to be. You know, I think we need to think in a new way about the so-called deep state, the elites that call the shots at the expense of all the rest of us.
I agree.
Getting away from the institutional left because it's pretty much hopeless, I think.
Well, once the Clintons took over, you knew it was going to be co-opted. Let me just tell you, the deep truth, visionaries speak out, this coming weekend, you're going to hear Mark Crispin Miller talking about the silence of the left, Ray McGovern on Russiagate, Jerry Daughtry on how history gets memory hold, an eye-opening case study, Allison Weir on how pro-Israel thought police are silencing Americans, Susie Dawson on Julian Assange censorship to death. That's just one panel. They have also got another panel with Dean Henderson on All Roads Lead to the City of London and on the oligarchy, resisting full-spectrum dominance. They've got another one on false flags with Barbara Harnicker. I have a lot of respect for Barbara.
Yes.
And old Damergaard. And then we have another panel with on the topic of triple blockade, the Israeli attack on Gaza, free speech and democracy. And then we have another panel on dark technology, geoengineering, 5G smart meters, and other Faustian bargains. That's a really important one.
Yes.
With Elena Freeland and Peter Kirby and Patrick Rohde and Jerry Day and Kevin Modis. This is important stuff to know. And then we have one on understanding Zionism. And so you've got five different panels, and this is something we should be open to. You could agree or disagree with what a panelist says, but we should not censor people because it is not politically correct for them to speak at free speech lectures. What an oxymoron that is.
Yeah, it's grotesque. Yeah, let's make clear, these panels are all online. The whole thing is online, so anyone can participate, anyone who's, you know, connected. So,
okay.
You know, I strongly urge people to tune in, and yeah, because you can't really destroy energy, right? I mean, you can block it.
That's correct.
On one throughway, but it's going to go somewhere else. So we just have to keep fighting.
And we will. Mark, deeptruth.info, deeptruth.info. I'll certainly be tuning into some of these because I find them important. And a lot of these people, I can't speak for all of them. I don't know all of them. But the ones I do know, I would invite on this program because they're legitimate progressive thinkers and activists. All the best. Professor Mark Crispin Miller. Mark, nice to speak with you again. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. We have more tomorrow.